somebody's telling me this funny story about one of his buds, and he finished, we were laughing, and then he had to tell me, he goes, "You don't really have any friends, do you, Dad?"
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, actor and travel writer Andrew McCarthy comes back on the show, this time to talk about male friendship, which is the topic of his new book, Who Needs Friends? This interview took place on stage at the Unity Temple on the Plaza in Kansas City, which was sponsored by Rainy Day Books. I originally meant to do this interview with Andrew while watching a Kansas City Royals versus Minnesota Twins baseball game, which we attended together earlier in the day. But before that happened, my wife Kiki pointed out that I shouldn't go to the game with Andrew for an interview. I should go with him as a friend. So that's what we did. The conversation we had there was the kind of wide-ranging chat two travel writers who've known each other for a long time might have, and I'm glad we didn't record it. The conversation I did record at the event later that day digs into Andrew's new book, which documents a road trip across America as he tries to reconnect with his old friends. He also talks about male friendships with random guys he meets along the way, which is fascinating. He and I discuss face-to-face intimacy versus side-by-side intimacy and how men's friendships differ from the friendships women cultivate. We talk about how loneliness affects your mental health and your physical health and how friendship might be different for younger generations. We talk about why Andrew loves Elvis Presley and how Elvis's life might be a cautionary tale when it comes to human connection. This is the first time Andrew has been on my podcast since he joined my Paris travel writing classes by Zoom to talk about the art of travel memoir a few years ago. More about those classes in the show notes or at pariswritingworkshops.com. I still have some openings available for this year's August class. For now, here's my conversation with Andrew in Kansas City last week. We begin just after Andrew has pointed out that I'm a Kansas native and just before I lose my train of thought talking about our experience at the baseball game. Let's listen in.
Actually, this ties into how I want to start the conversation, because the other day I was sitting, my wife sent me this email and she says, "There's this article from The Atlantic about male friendship and I want you to read it because you need more friends." And I read it and it's like, Andrew wrote that. Andrew is my friend. And so today we went to the Royals game, which was not very fun for the Royals, but...
We forgot what it is.
Right, yeah, it was so traumatizing. But yeah, no, I'm your token Kansas friend. You know, a lot of people who live in New York are from Kansas, but I'm your token Kansas friend.
So. True.
So I'll start by saying this is sort of a road trip story. Why do a road trip seeking to talk to men about male friendship?
Well, I didn't intend to start to write a book, even. How long is a piece of string, right? So I was sitting at the kitchen table, my son was telling me this funny story about one of his buds, and he finished, we were laughing, and then he had to tell me this, "You don't really have any friends, do you, Dad?" I mean, this is what kids do, right? They just sort of talk direct, and you know, and as far as he knew, he was just telling me the truth. But as with all of us who have children, there's more to the story of our life than our children are aware, right? So anyway, I looked at my son, and I said, "Yeah, I have friends in me, I just don't see them. But I know they're there, and that's enough." And I wasn't joking. And because I, like many people, when I was a young guy, I moved into the city from New Jersey at 17 years old, and I got this core group of friends, who were several friends who were my chosen family, and they were the guys I hung with, and sort of were foundational friendships in my life who helped me become the person I would eventually become. And over the course of life and marriages and jobs and, you know, living, they all moved away from the city. And it turns out I hadn't seen any of them in years and years. And so I thought, I sat with Sam's Mark and I thought about him for a couple of days. And I thought, you know what? It's not enough. I need to go see my friends. So that said, so I called them all up, these five guys that I knew, and I said, I need to go see my friends. I called them all up and I said, "Hey, I want to come see you, you know, because I haven't seen someone like in decades." And all of them said, "Yeah, that sounds great, I'm too busy, I can't really do that." And anyhow, so I eventually went down to see one friend who lived in Baltimore, only 4 hours away, but I mean, and so I went down to see him. And then I said, "Well, I'm already kind of in Baltimore, and Kentucky's not that far, so I just sort of kept going." And then, as you allude to, and I'll stop in a second, I began to start to talk to other men along the way that I met about friendship and the place friendship had in their lives. I would approach random men on the street and guess that she's born. And I just kind of go, hi there, could you talk to me about your friends? They all looked at me like I was, you know, nuts. But I said, well, no, I'm on my way. I'm going to see old friends I haven't seen in years. And they're all like, oh, that's a great thing to be doing. And, you know, and so I would start chatting with them, and they would tell me their experience of friendship, and all these themes started to emerge. And so I started asking men, and, you know, cops in Ohio, blues musicians in Mississippi, oil rig workers in Texas, all just all over. Every man I kind of would stop and talk to. And what was interesting to me was not a single man said no to me. They all kind of, even the ones who were always kind of guarded, said, and then invariably most men said to me, you know, I never talk about this. Never. And most of them wanted to keep talking long after I was sort of ready to wrap it up. You know, it's just something they don't address sort of. So anyway, it turned into this improvisational 10,000 miles. And I hate the land, and I'll stop. I hate highways and interstates. I'm terrified of trucks going by. They stress me out. So I just go back roads the whole way. And that's why it took me 10,000 miles to get across the country. But and being a travel writer, then it's sort of, you know, if you can go, I-70 the whole way, you never see anything except gas stations and trucks. So, but when you get out in America, and it's still kind of fantastic out in America. So when people are open and generous and gracious and welcoming and peculiar and kind of wonderful, you know. So that's how it sort of evolved. And somewhere in the middle of like Western, I know I was in West Virginia when I thought, oh, there's a book in here. Because I just read these guys and talk to these, it's fascinating.
Well, I'm curious to dig into sort of what conclusions, what you heard from men across America. But I'm curious in the audience, who here was born between 1960 and 1980? Everybody. So I'm right in the middle, I'm 1970. And so I first knew him as an actor. I think we sort of project a completeness upon actors. I've known Andrew for a long time, but once, quite recently on my podcast, I was sort of talking to him as if he knew Arnold Schwarzenegger, as if everybody I saw on the screen in Wichita when I was a kid knew each other. But in reading your book, your friends are sort of normal guys. They're knuckleheads. They have their own idiosyncrasies and insecurities. And so what was your methodology, or did you have one, as you traveled across America? And nobody, I guess you wrote a book called Brat, which is about the Brat Pack as a metaphor for celebrity friendship, but there's no Brat Pack people in your book that I recall. And so what kinds of friends did you seek out? Were they childhood friends? Were they young adult friends or adult friends?
I went to see five. I went to, my purpose was to reunite with five friends. Three of them were people I'd met when I was very young, you know, 17, one, you know, early 20s, that kind of thing. One of them was an actor, but you wouldn't know. And then two of the men who I met, you know, 30 years ago. Those are the most recent kind of friendships. So, but all of my, you know, when I became successful in the public way very young, like 22, 23, I gravitated even more to my friendships that I had before with these guys, just because I felt safe with them. I asked everybody when I was traveling what one word describes safety, friendship to you. And very most men kind of said trust, you know. And when the person asked me what one word I would say, I said safety, which encompasses trust, but it's something more. It seems bigger to me. It seems like just I feel swaddled and safe with my friends. And I suppose that may come from having been successful in a public way in my early 20s when a lot of people were coming at me and stuff. And a lot of people always invariably say, oh, you must have had a lot of people wanting friendships with you when they wanted something, you know. And the first thing you learn as a celebrity of any sort is have that spidey sense, and you can tell instantly when somebody's just wanting that. So it's really a non-issue. You know, everyone always thinks that, and I would think that too. It's just a non-issue. People kind of coming at you wanting to be a friend because you're, you know, they think you're this or that, and invariably you just can tell something. So you know, you're polite and go, no, you're not getting close. You know, so it's not, I never had a case really where I was just like gobsmacked, oh my God, they were exploiting me. That just never happened to me.
Why do you think you had not seen these guys for a long time? And what did you discover as you sought them out?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I think one of the things I found is I'm not alone in that. I mean, there are all sorts of statistics, staggering statistics about men, friendship in decline with men. And I think 70% of men now say they have no close friends in 1990. That was 3%. 25% of men who have only high school diplomas say they have no close friends at all. I mean, 1 in 5 men say they have had emotional support from a man in the last month. All sorts of these crazy statistics. And then loneliness, of course, is, you know, this is not, loneliness is a staggering kind of thing, both male and female, of, I'll just bore you with some more statistics. There's a 50% increased risk of dementia for people that are socially isolated. There's a 38% chance of heart disease. The statistics go on and on. And 15%, being lonely, people that are socially isolated and lonely have a, it's as if they're taking, smoke 15 cigarettes a day and six alcohol drinks a day, the health effects. You know, so loneliness isn't just like, oh, that's really sad. It's like, no, physically killing us. And, you know, well, what are the reasons for that? You know, all sorts of things like social media, whatever, all. But the bottom line is that that's just what's happening. And I encountered a lot of that in my trip across America. I asked everyone also if they were lonely. People get lonely. And all the young guys I talked to, young guys are like, oh yeah, 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 I'm all the time. And all the older dudes, my age, and, you know, and they, I said, you get lonely?
No, no, too busy, I have too much going on.
And I always, when I answer that quickly, I'm either lying or it's something I'm afraid of, you know? And I, because the thing is, to admit loneliness to a man, this is my hypothesis, is an admission, a tacit admission of weakness. And the one thing a man can never be and demonstrate is weakness. And so we're not going to admit our loneliness, so that keeps us further isolated. It just makes it even more of a self-perpetuating thing, you know. And the other thing, of course, men have difficulty with is this notion of vulnerability, because that can be construed as some kind of, again, weakness. Some have vulnerability and weakness have gotten hammered together, and they have nothing to do with each other, of course. But, and, you know, and the word intimacy is a terrifying thing to say to most men, because that can be construed as, oh, the sex thing going on there, you know what I mean? And what that has nothing, again, nothing to do with intimacy. You know, I met these two dudes, these two old guys, I was in Ohio, I went to a gas station, I was filling up, and I went in to buy a Slurpee, and then it's one of those gas stations slash convenience store slash fast food things that are on the edge of every town that are ruining America, those stores, and there were these two old geezers sitting there having coffee, and from across the room, like, they were in their 70s, I could tell they were like, bonded, and so I just walked over and said, can I talk to you? Sit down! And they were happy to have some new blood. And so Lou and Bobby, they'd been friends since, they were in their 70s, they'd been friends since they were 10 and 12 years old, and they had the most extraordinary deep bond, and it was such a beautiful thing to see. And it was completely alien to me. I just couldn't understand that level of intimacy with another man. And I was so awed by them. And you know, and Lou said to me, well, Lou, yeah, we started saying I love you to each other a couple of years ago. I mean, I tell my wife I love her, I tell my kids I love her, why can't I tell my best bud I love him? And Bobby said, yeah, well, we haven't graduated to a goodnight kiss yet. But which was speaking, of course, to that sense of intimacy, of being, you know, confused with sex. And what I found fascinating about these guys, this is really a deep dive into these guys, but Lou told me, and this Lou, these were tough guys. These were former cops. They were EMT guys. They were just hard. And you know, they said, we're good old boys who aren't afraid of hard work and like things done right. And they were just direct. And Lou said to me, you know, I stopped having sex. And he said this to me twice. And I'm like, okay. But there was something, you know, when hard guys, tough guys, ruthless businessmen become these really soft, tender, doting grandfathers. That kind of on. It's like these guys had lost all their hardness and their edge, and they've just become so tender and sweet and open. And I thought it made me think after I'd left them, I thought their idea that they'd stopped having sex, which he felt compelled to tell me twice, was a certain yielding of a certain power that men have, and just even on a physical level, I mean, yielding and a relinquishing of that power. And what was left for them was a certain tenderness and vulnerability and kindness and empathy that was so lovely. And I dare say that they, in the loss of that power, that manly power, because they had each other always, they didn't become angry and bitter and resentful, and they had someone to share all that with. You know, Lou said, He says, I feel a lot of guys I know, they're afraid to leave their house now. They're diminished men of what they used to be. They used to be hard driving guys, and now they're diminished. They don't want to go out because they're embarrassed and ashamed of what they've become as old guys. And I feel like I should get a bus and go take them all out to breakfast. You know what I mean? But anyway, I found that kind of, as life goes on, the transitions that are made. Anyway, these two had each other all the way through, I guess, is the bottom line. And then in that kind of friendship, I was just awed by them. And I, of course, in my urban, you know, sophisticated, snobby way, I thought, here are two old geezers. What the hell do they have to offer? And I spent 2.5 hours chatting with these guys. You know, and I came away just blown away by their... I digress.
No, that's really lovely, actually. But you said earlier that nobody said, no, I don't want to talk about friendship. And so maybe the guys who weren't quite so enlightened, who weren't I love you friends, who weren't I don't have sex anymore friends, what did men say? I mean, how did they self-analyze their own friendship or lack of friendship?
Well, I said most guys said they'd never talked about this. So a lot of people were surprising themselves when they talked to me. But I was also not interviewing people. I was just talking to people. And I was sort of sharing of myself. Like, I'm on my way to see some old friends. I saw one friend. I'm on my way in Kentucky. Now I'm on my way to Texas. You know, so I started sharing. And go, oh, that's amazing. I should do that. I just had this guy. Oh, man, we were great friends. Yeah, we had a falling out. You know, and then he would go on. And, you know, and then, excuse me. That's what he said. Another guy in the small town in Nevada, in Eureka, Nevada, this old ghost town, and he said, yeah, I never had friends. That didn't work for me. And he was in the Army Corps of Engineer for a long time, and he was retired, and he said, yeah, it just didn't work for me. I said, you're married? He goes, yeah, 40 years. Well, you talk to your wife? No. I'm like, wow, that must be tough. And he went, yeah. I said, no, I was thinking for her. And he went, huh? Okay. But whatever. I mean, you know, it worked for them, I guess. But, you know, there's just a lot of, but there's a lot of that out there, too. You know, and again, I encountered a lot of guys that were, you know, deep friendships and then people that had no friendships.
Did you have any road trip writing models for this? Are there any American road trip books that you looked to? Or were you, as a writer, just sort of feeling your own way?
Well, I luckily didn't know I was writing a book when I started. So I was, the whole thing, and discovering America the way I discovered America. I hadn't been in America like that. I've never been down to Mississippi before. I'd never been all the way across Texas and West Texas and up to some of the West and everything. And so I was discovering America anew in a certain way. So I had wonder-filled eyes. You know, and I was really pleasantly, happily discovering America. Like, and I was in small towns all the time. You know, I would go to the diner and find where the diner was in the small town, and about 7,000 seemed to be the ideal size for a small town. There's enough buzz going on, and yet it is small enough where you easily make contact. And so I started searching out towns of that size. And I have to say, and I think I write this in the book, the breakfast is the most optimistic meal of the day. People in diners, they just sit around and have coffee and they're chatting and invariably there's a big table in the middle of the room usually of old guys in their mesh caps and their Carhartt jackets and they're just sitting there talking and they're just solving all the problems of the world. And it's fantastic. You know, I was in one of these in West Virginia, in Elkins, West Virginia, and there was a big table of guys like that and I wanted to approach them, but I felt intimidated too. So I didn't. Then anyway, I started chatting with people next table, and I said, oh, is that the brain trust over there? And they were like, well, they'd like to think so. but then she said, but they got each other anyway, thank God. And that really was it in a nutshell. You know, and then one old guy would get up and leave. People would barely say goodbye because they know they're going to see him tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And one guy would get up, and then a few minutes later, some other old guy would come up with a mesh hat and sit down. And it was just kind of, I was gobsmacked America in that way. I just thought it was wonderful. So I didn't have a place. I had read Travels with Charlie when I was doing the previous book. I did a walking book, Walking Crooks, and I don't know why I read that Steinbeck book, Travels with Charlie. Because I knew I wanted to call my book Walking with Sam, so I picked up Travels with Charlie, which I think is a largely a bogus book. Have you ever read that book? It's a John Steinbeck book where he drives across the country with his dog. I think he made a lot of that up. I mean, I can't swear to it, but there's a whole scene in Chicago.
Now, people have mapped that book out, and like literally, he couldn't have been point A to point B.
Oh, really? Yeah.
There's a lot of. It's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book, but the questions have been asked about that. I was surprised by one detail in your book, Andrew, and I'm curious to know what surprised you about America, not just in conversations, but just in places that surprised you. I didn't know you were an Elvis fan.
Oh, I love Elvis. Yeah.
Tell me more.
I think Elvis was, you know, Elvis only had a little light, you know, but I'm a huge believer in this whole concept, which I'm about to say. There's the moment of blossoming, there is nothing more attractive in the world, which is why people, why most of you are here. I was 22 years old, I was just, my life was just blossoming, and it happened in movies, right then, and all of us young people, and it's like the sunrise, you know, there's 5 minutes of absolute beautiful pink, purple, incredible sky. It flashes and then it moves on, and the day begins. And I think so many times when people are young, I mean, you see it with James Dean in his movies, and so with Elvis, more than anyone I've ever seen, with a 19-year-old kid, he just couldn't stop moving, and he just had to say, he didn't know what he was doing. He just was being, and life force was pouring through, and it was so attractive. And people just looked at it and said, I want that. And it's like when I was in members of the Brat Pack and those movies, not to the degree of Elvis, God knows, but it was, you know, people look at those movies, even now, they can, you guys come up to me and you start talking about it, oh, Pretty in Pink, oh man, when I, and then you start talking and your eyes glaze over. And I realize very quickly you're not talking to me, you're talking to your own youth. And I'm like the avatar of that youth. And you're like, oh, because your life, you were 17, 18, whatever it was, and you were just, your friends were this, and you're just having your own life for the first time, and your life's a blank slate to be written upon, and there's no more thrilling life, time in life than that. It's just, the blossom is happening, you know? And I think it's an amazing time of life. And I thought Elvis is the ultimate example. By 22, he was done, you know? He was off in the war, and he was in the draft in the army, and he came home a junkie on pills, you know? The great irony of Elvis is, being a bad boy, and he was just a mama's boy as a kid. He went into the army to get legit, so he'd be palatable for mainstream America. He came home addicted to pills and never got off them as a junkie because, you know, but he had that innocent, but and he had it going on. And I don't know how anyone could survive that. I mean, in a certain way, it almost killed me being successful and that I would agree I was when I was young. It was too much for me. And Elvis was 10,000 times that. How could anyone survive that kind of assault and people coming after? Because that boss I'm talking about, the one thing everybody wants is, oh, I want it. You know what I mean? And it's, there are countless examples of James Dean was it and he died. You know, couldn't take it, crashed his car while he was still in blossom. And that's how we always think James Dean, oh my God. Because he never got a chance to go beyond the blossom. Anyway. That's my main theory. So yeah, I love Elvis. So I went to Elvis's birthplace in Tupelo, Mississippi, which is incredible. And Graceland is great. Tupelo is amazing. Mississippi itself, I thought, was amazing. There's not much money, so it's unadorned. You know, when there isn't money in the masquerade things, you just see a place and it's unadorned. But Mississippi is a wonderful place. I've been back 4 or 5 times since.
Do you know what Elvis's friendships were like?
Elvis had one great line. Well, Elvis had a problem because he couldn't trust people and he had no education, so he had his posse, you know, his Memphis Mafia, you know, his buds that he just, but they were just yes men, you know what I mean? And so that was unfortunate. He didn't have anyone telling him the truth. But Elvis did say his friends are people you can talk to without words when you need to. And I thought, you know, Elvis was very astute, so the way all self-educated people are. But anyway. And Elvis was awesome, and I thought going to his birthplace was kind of great.
Oh, this ties into something we were talking about this afternoon. I asked you about your legacy, because you this is your fifth book, yeah. And you're like, no, of course, you know, when I die, it's going to be Brat Pack Guy. Brat Pack Guy died, but in a way, there's something healthy about that. I think you know, it's you know, you're seeking out, like you're sort of, you're a travel writer now. Are you a friendship guru now? Can you give people?
My wife, when I told her I was going to write a book on friendship, she went, you are writing a book about friendship? God help us. I said, who better than the guy that like has not respected or honored his friendship? You know, my wife has so many friends and is so wildly. So women are, I do think women are just intuitively just so much better at this than men are. There was a place, I was in Palestine, Texas, and I was having lunch at this restaurant. There was a table full of about 12, 16 women. It was Texas, and they were all dressed up to the nines, and their hair was really big, and you know, and they're all this jewelry, and they're laughing, drinking their white wines, having a fantastic time. And I just walk over after my little solitary meal, and I go, what's the occasion, ladies? And they went, it's Wednesday, darling. And I was like, every Wednesday? Every Wednesday. And I did. I said to him, why are you so much better at this than guys are? You know, someone said, it's a line I heard recently, and I've stolen it, that women make friendships face-to-face, and guys make friendships shoulder-to-shoulder. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Like, if my wife meets someone that she likes, she's going to go up and say, do you want to have a cup of coffee tomorrow? And yeah, okay, great, and they'll get together, and they'll sit for 3 hours and chat. And like, well, we would just not do that. We may go to a Yankee game and sit there and watch the game. Or, you know, I do think men demonstrate love and intimacy in action. But, you know, I met a guy who recently had a book thing, and he said he couldn't tell his daughter that he loved her, but he, without blinking, get in the car and drive her 8 hours back to college without thinking twice. You know what I mean? I had a neighbor of mine, and we had a shared backyard, and I knew him for 6-8 months. I was like, hey, I'm one of the good friends to make good neighbors on that guy. And so I go, hi, hi, Dan, how you doing? And, but one day I was building a basketball hoop for my kid. And so in the backyard, I'm a terrible DIY guy. I'm just like, ugh. So I'm, you know, and he pops his head over the fence. You know, I'm like, do you know how to do that? And he goes, comes over, and we spent the next 4 hours building this basketball hoop. And by the time we were done, we were friends. And we've been dear friends ever since. You know what I mean? We needed this sort of bonding experience to happen. You know, I think there's all these things like, you know, guys don't play golf together, and when he goes home, well, how's Mary doing? You know, his wife. I don't know if you mentioned. She just had cancer. How's she doing? Oh, you mentioned it. And it's like, what did you talk about? Well, nice shot. You know, but there's something in the action of that that does create a certain intimacy that then they come home relaxed and better for. You know what I mean? And so I just think we do it differently. But one's not necessarily better than the other, but I do think women have an easier time or more. But because again, vulnerability, intimacy, things like that, that guys tend to recoil from a little bit.
Will you, I want to give things over to the audience for audience questions in a second here, but you travel around America, you didn't seek out women, even though it seems they have more in friendship wisdom at some level than men.
Well, not entirely true. I mean, I guess this book to me, when it's about connection, really. And women seem to be doing it better, so they weren't the ones having the problem. So I was also reading my male, I was in Australia, I did more focus on male friendships. But to me, the book was really about the notion of connection and how do we have connection and just be less alone and isolated. But sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no worries. Actually, I guess my last question before you go to the audience, is there anything like lessons learned, prescriptions? I mean, you met these guys who were very comfortable with each other in their feed caps, drinking coffee, who seem exemplary in a way. You have these I love you guys. You met a lot of people, you reconnected with your friends. What are some of your takeaways?
Well, the biggest thing, I'm just a guy. I'm not a social scientist. I'm not I'm just a guy who just like, guy driving across the country, meeting his friends again, you know, and hopefully you're coming with me as a co-pilot, you know what I mean, riding shotgun with me. But the one thing I can say I take away, my biggest takeaway from the whole thing was I showed up. You know, I'm a big believer in the older I get, the cliche, 95% of life is showing up. And I just think that's absolutely true. And however imperfectly or haltingly we show up, I think you just show up. I would knock on my friend's door and they'd say, drove here to see me? I'm like, dude, you know, you've been so important in my life, and I've been a really lax friend, and I just wanted you to know that I want to see you. You're important in my life. You know, Aristotle talks about, because we get highbrow in the book, Aristotle talks about the three layers of friendship, and he talks about the third layer, this what we call perfect friendship, where two people acknowledge their friendship to each other, which I wasn't consciously doing, because I didn't know this at the time, I learned this after when I was researching. They acknowledge that friendship to each other, and in the acknowledgement of it, it takes it to a sort of deeper level. And that was exactly my experience. I would say to my friend, I came. He said, you came on? Yeah, you're important to me. I just need you to know that. Well, dude, you're important to me. I'm so glad you came here. And we never would have been able to do that, A, in our younger years, and we just never did. But now that we're, you know, older, we just kind of was able to just sort of name it. And it brought us in a much more sort of close, intimate level, and just an accepted, unconscious way. And I did feel as I drove across the country, I had found this sort of safety net of friendship spreading out underneath me, of support, in a way. You know, I asked a lot of people, there's a lot of men, and I think it's a universal thing I discovered. And I certainly felt that something I started wrestling with. So I was going, well, do you feel the need to provide? And every guy was just like, yeah, it's the biggest thing on over my head in my life, of course. And my wife is much more capable than me in most ways in life. She's, you know, wild, you know, keeps her head better in a panic than anyone I know. But I feel this over, or whatever this, you know, cloud, rock over me of this sense of I need to provide, whether it comes from caveman stuff, bringing home the brontosaurus or whatever it was, like men need to provide, whether however realistic that is or not. And I think found men, the degree to which we have self-esteem is the degree to which we are fulfilling that need in ourselves. You know what I mean? So I found that really true. And every guy when I talked to about it, they just went, okay. Whereas my wife is like, you're doing fine, sweetheart. Why are you feeling like, so you just don't understand what it is. Whether it's rational or not, I just, and every guy I talked to, but do you feel that way?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and I just thought it was a huge thing to find that every other guy would just kind of go, yeah. Well, maybe it just relieved me so much. I just relaxed in a way I hadn't relaxed in a long time. I didn't realize how alone I felt in my struggles through life, you know, and I love my family, my kids, my own. Fantastic, I have an amazing life. And yet how solitary I felt in it so much of the time. And so reconnecting with these people, talking to these other men, put sort of a safety net underneath me. I didn't know I would have felt lacking. So that was a good, I learned that.
Yeah, and that feels like that flows out of showing up. You know, you show up and then the other things happen.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting, when my wife sent me the article that was written by you without knowing that it was, she said, oh, it's capturing the zeitgeist. I think there's a lot of articles now about the manosphere, or about, I read a New Yorker article about the alpha male boot camp or something. And it's like,
run for the hills.
So maybe we don't need to go to alpha male boot camp. Maybe we just need to show up for each other, you know?
Well, I do think there's this, I was in Comstock, Texas, which is a tiny non-town. It was a one motel, like the Bates Motel in Psycho. It was like one of those motels. And there was a gas station across the street and a bar. That was the town. And I was the only guest in it. And then this guy showed up on a motorcycle, Harley, like at a central casting. Big guy, beard, leathers. And he shows up, he's in the room next to me. And I was sitting outside my room watching the moon rise over the wire fence. And that's what you do in Comstock. And that's what I was doing. And he was tinkering with his bike and we started chatting. And I said, what are you doing? Where are you going? And he said, yeah, I'm riding. Yeah, I got a big decision in life. I go left or I go right. I'm letting the road tell me what to do. And I was like, cool. But underneath what he was saying, I heard this pride in this, that's what a man does. You go it alone, you carry your own water, you pull your hat down, you don't show weakness, and you figure it out yourself. And somewhere along the way, that has become, by the end of the Second World War, by the advent of John Wayne and all this stuff, that's what the American male ideal became, a version of that. That's stoic, hard, pull your hat down, you deal with it. And that's not how friendship and manhood in America used to be always. And like even back in the mid-19th century with Abraham Lincoln, when he had a very famous friendship with Joshua Speed, who is, some people say, more than friendship now. But men back then wrote what we would consider love letters to each other constantly. There was physical affection between men. It was a much different expression of heterosexual male friendship back in the day. And somewhere between the mid-19th century, by the time the Second World War happened, man in America became macho. That's what strong is. That's what we are. And I think to our detriment. And so this guy was being this way, and I looked at him, and I had two reactions. My first reaction was insecurity, because I was never a macho dude. I mean, my living as a young guy, being sensitive and vulnerable and kind of that. And so I was never physically big, so I was never going to be a macho dude. So I my adjustment was, but I always felt less, not man enough in a certain way in that regard. So my first reaction when he was not showing up, I was like, oh, this is a weak kind of. And then my other reaction when I'd been through enough therapy and lived long enough to know, well, that's probably not really true, Andrew. I know you have that voice, but it's not really true. But my other reaction is my urbanite snob going, this hick. I'm much more sophisticated, and I feel overserving in that kind of way. Well, this is subconscious taking 2 seconds, of course. But, and then I thought, no, you know what? You don't need either of those things. You can just sit here, being who you are, as a man, and he's doing his thing as a man, and you can have a nice chat. And it was a huge learning thing for me. I'm fine where I'm at in my, journey of manhood or whatever. And he's cool wherever he's at. And to be able to just sort of, and then we had a lovely chat. You know, I just thought that was really interesting. That's why I've always said the road is the university of my life, travel. And that was like an example. I just learned about myself so much sitting in that parking lot, Comstock. Anyway.
Questions for Andrew.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being here tonight. My question is, how long has it been since you actually finished your travels? And how has your friendship shifted or changed with all these people that you went to go see since then? Like, is it really different?
Yeah, it's been about a year and a half now. And I have much more contact with all of them. I just talked to one about an hour ago and texted with the other while I was walking over here. I've seen a couple of them multiple times. And spoiler alert, at the end of the book, I was talking to one of them on the phone and laughing, really having a silly laugh. And I hung up the phone and Sam, who said to me at the beginning, he's the one that said, you don't really have any friends. He said, it's so nice that you talk to your friends like that, laughing, it's awesome. And I said, well, Sam, it's thanks to you, really. You're the one that sent me on this road trip when you said I didn't have any friends. And he was like, I did? But yeah, so I have actively kept, we've kept each other in our lives, so.
Thank you.
Less with friends that aren't as close, like Rob, we call it, like, we know each other a long time, we're friends, but one of us doing baseball games today, so I'm in town today, it's like awesome.
Side by side intimacy.
There you go. Oh, we lost.
So, two quick questions. One, do you feel like this younger generation of males is doing it a little bit differently? Does Sam have friends?
I think the young, there's all this, of course, and it's all true, everything they say, everyone says about social media and everything, but there's a certain way that social media has certainly helped young people. The shame that we said that it seems like a lot of people from my generation had about emotions and feelings that we would keep hidden and back. The young people because of TikTok or whatever, and they're acting now, they're putting stars on it instead of hiding it. Putting things on it. And there's a certain way of this sort of lack of shame and sharing, oversharing as people say, that I think is kind of lovely. And my son does have good friends. One of the things I really learned, we're talking to these two guys on my trip, and they said something and it hit me like a brick upside the head. I realized one of my greatest failings is a parent. Because our kids don't listen, right? They don't listen to anything we say. But they see our behavior that we model for them, and that's what they learn from us, right? And one of my biggest failings as a parent is my not modeling friendship for my children. Luckily, my wife is wildly social, so she has people coming and going all the time and dragging us off to various people's houses. It's awful. We hate it, and we come back, oh, that was really fun. And my wife's like, oh. Anyway, but so I really realized that was a real family of mine. So it was very humbling that. So anyway, my experience with young people, they had had a certain kind of freedom and intimacy that we didn't have. Like, they want to hang around with their parents, too. And it's not just my kids. It's not like word breakers, but like, when I was gone at 17, I was gone. You never saw me again. And they never, but kids, they just keep coming back, and like, I think it's fantastic. So, they are certainly different. And they communicate a little better than I did. I never communicated with my parents about anything. They didn't know anything of my emotional life.
So this question is somewhat friendship related. For many of us, Salem on Fire was such a turning point for us in seeing those friendship groups living with the complications and the good times and the bad times. So there's been rumor going around that St. Elmo's Fire, maybe getting part two.
What's interesting about those movies, something that and like The Breakfast Club, is that normally the center of movies is romance, and the romance center of these movies was friendship. You know what I mean? That's one of the things that, you know, and yes, there is talk of doing it. You know, they better hurry up because we'll be late for tomorrow. Maybe we're all like in a sort of assisted living facility. Look at Ralph Skinwalker. But, you know, we'll see about that. I, you know, I've heard that deal would happen. Nobody's called up to check. But I think the notion of friendship being the center of those movies is, you know, was a big deal.
I have a process question. So you wrote the book. You obviously spent a lot of time reading what you wrote, and then you went back and read the book for the audio book. When you went back and read what you've written, are there any things that you kind of wished you added that you didn't include in the book when you went back and read through it again and had to go through that process? You felt like, oh, I wish I added that. I wish I added that.
That's a good question. I heard. But to back that up even further, someone said, when I read this once and I thought it was really true, you know, I'd be curious your opinion on this. When you have to write something and then you have to put it down, you have to leave it alone long enough to forget what you were trying to say so that when you read it, you can see if you said it. If you track that thinking. And I thought that was really good. Your friend, the guy who mentioned it, Jeff Dyer, he said that.
Jeff Dyer.
Yeah. And so anyway, so when. When I read the audiobook, which I'm terrible at reading the audiobooks, But that's because I have a wonderful editor. Because I'm making mistakes every like two lines. Like I can't even read the book. I'm making mistakes. And finally, one book I was reading of mine, one of the person said, and did you write this book? Because that didn't seem like you've even read it before. Because I kept making mistakes all the time. So, but I didn't wish I'd said more. There were things I wish I'd cut, and some things I did cut when I was doing the audiobook. I was just, we don't need this. I'm just, don't tell the writer I'm cutting this. And I would just cut a paragraph or two. So there was more, and you know, John Cooley, what's that famous Mark Twain line, if I had more time, I would have made it shorter. You know, I think that's, you never go wrong cutting. I don't think you ever go wrong cutting. You can't be short enough, particularly in the way our attention span is now. But yeah, so it was more not wishing I'd added things, but wishing I'd cut things. Or sometimes, if I thought a little more closely about that sentence, if that's a little lazy, you know. Or word repetition. It's like, why didn't my editor catch it? I repeated that word twice there, you know. That's always the one thing. And it's amazing, you can read things 1,000 times, right? And you just don't see it. And then sometimes I go, oh my God, how can I not have seen that? And how can nobody saw that? What's the matter with that? Anyway.
Are you still friends with anyone you met on your travels? And what's the scariest or creepiest thing that happened on your travels?
What was the scariest or creepiest
thing that happened on my trip?
And are you still friends with?
With the creepy people? I'm still in touch with some of them because I would send them what I wrote about them, some of them, you know. Particularly, I'm still friends, I don't know if you've read, but there were these guys I met down in Kentucky that were horse people, horse guys. And they're really good at kind of reaching out to me all the time and, you know, sending me photos and like. So I'm in touch with half a dozen of them on a sort of active level, on an email kind of texting level. And creepy, weird things, you know, the only creepy, weird things was when I got in a motel, I opened money and pulled. Because I didn't make any reservations, it was all improvisation, I had no plan. And I stayed as cheap as possible because I wanted to travel as close to the ground as possible. You know, you stay in a nice hotel, you don't learn anything. You just go with concierge, so you go to the restaurant. You say, you know, I take these cheap little motels. And so I, you know, one bed I got into, I pulled it down, and it was just spiders all over. I was in Vernal, Utah, so anyway. But there are a lot of, because I didn't want to stay in chains either. I didn't want to stay in, I wanted to stay in like mom and pop places.
Better stories.
Yeah.
So mine's less a question, but more of a statement on male friendship. So I live in a really old neighborhood in Kansas City called Strawberry Hill, and it's got a Croatian history to it. It's a 100-year-old neighborhood, which is not unusual on the East Coast, but it is kind of here. My daughter works at the bar across the street from our house, and every Wednesday night, there are 4 80-year-old men who come in and drink together. And they have been friends since they were kids. And it has been probably one of the more meaningful things in my 23-year-old daughter's life, is every Wednesday night looking forward to these old guys coming in, telling their stories, just like you kind of shared here tonight. And I will let you know that when I finish reading this book, I'm going to hand it off to them.
Okay. There's a lot of that out there in America, you know, and so it was so heartening to me to go out because we're so polarized politically and everything now in our country. There's so much, you know, and I actively did not talk about politics once to anyone across the whole country. I also, once people are from politics, they just get militant and angry, whatever they get. It's just they know, and that's it, and we're not talking, you know. And I wasn't interested. I was interested in softness and openness and like, what do you, you know, and I found all that all over the place, whether those, you know, America's still a wondrous, kind of open-hearted, really gracious, generous, kind, welcoming place. And I was just bowled over by that. And people that I thought were just, I would dismiss outright in my arrogance. I would just turn out to be the most lovely kind of people, and kind to me. And then I would always go, wow, you jerk, Andrew. This is the, you know what I mean? I just learned a lot about, like, my East Coast hubris.
So my question is, when you were talking to these people, did they recognize you? And if they did that make it easier or harder for them to open up to you?
A lot of people ask me that, and I'm always, my first answer is, well, I'm not Brad Pitt. But the other thing is, I was so out of context that, like, in Mississippi, where, like, I'm just a random guy going, you know, and I probably haven't showered much in a couple of days, you know, right? You know what I'm saying? And some people did, a lot of people, like, you look familiar, where are you from? You right here? And, you know, and occasionally people would recognize me, and then they just go, like, yeah, I'm just going to see my friends across the country. And, ah, that's cool. I like those movies, yeah, that's good. You know, and it's also, but also, in life, you know, like I said, I'm an introverted person. That kind of, when people do, it's opened doors to me much more than it sort of, it can separate you to certain degrees. Like we were alluding to earlier about people coming out to you, you know, can you really tell what they're thinking? But it's from, more often than not, it's opened doors for me in a way that I just wouldn't have. Because I can go somewhere and have a great time and not speak to anyone. But there were people who sort of recognize and include me and sort of bring me into something. It's often something I never would have. Serious. Although Rolf and I were talking about this earlier, when you're out on the road and you're writing something, you become kind of character of yourself. You're not fake, but you're not the person you would be if you weren't writing. You're kind of, you got your little, you know, explorer hat on, and you just become, certain facets of your personality come to the fore. And it's a very attractive quality, usually, because it's more engaged, it's more curious, it's more interested, it's more, your spidey sense is up, your eye for detail is sharp, and you become this sort of aspect of yourself that's kind of even more than your day-to-day self, in a really attractive way. And so, that's what I find more than anything when I'm traveling, and when I love travel writing, being on assignment for a magazine or for a book, because you are this sort of better version of yourself. I'm more engaged with the world, and I have more appetite for the world in that way. And whenever we have more appetite for the world, I mean, that's what travel does. It's my life. I said, it makes us wondrous again. It's like, who's been to the Trevi Fountain? Who's been to Rome? And the Trevi Fountain, it's a wow. It's a beautiful thing. And I remember going to the Trevi Fountain and finding this beautiful old massive fountain. It's spectacular. And my wife and I were fighting. And we're there together, and I'm trying to find this damn place, and it's hot, and I'm looking at the map, and my wife's like, well, ask somebody. I'm like, oh, we'll find it. I'm like, guy, I'm not asking directions. Anyway, we turn around the corner and see the Trevi Fountain at night, and it's so beautiful, lit up. I have this gasp, and I'm just, my jaw drops, and suddenly my wife reaches, and I can feel her grab my hand, and suddenly we're not fighting anymore, and I'm no longer that cynical, jaded, tired, grumpy person she sits across breakfast from, and she is now suddenly this wide-eyed, lovely, young, innocent person that I fell in love with, and we have this moment of connection. And that's what I think travel does for us. We're the better versions of ourselves when we're out there. That moment of connection, when we're holding hands like that, that'll last me 10 times longer than a vacation where I'm laying on a beach. You know what I mean? So I find that was not an answer to your question at all. But I think of that moment, and I always realize that's what travel is to me versus vacation. Because when I'm vacationing, to really know myself, I want to be pampered, I want to be treated special, I want all the rough edges to be worn out, I want everything the way I want it, and I want it now. And none of that's really in my best interest, and I'm not the most attractive version of myself when I'm behaving like that. And you know what I mean? So I'd much rather travel than vacation. And travel isn't always fun, for I always think travel doesn't have to be fun. I'm not traveling to have a good time. I'm traveling to experience the world and experience my life fully. And being on the leading edge of my life and experiencing a sense of wonder and openness again, that's why I travel. That's what I love most about life. And travel is the easiest way to do that. You know what I mean? So do people recognize me? Often, but they often more recognize that energy of appetite. And like, sit down, man. This is a great conversation we're having. Because they recognize that sort of, again, it's like dawn again of that sunrise more. I have that young, wondrous kind of appetite in my life. I'm interested in you. My life is blank slate. Tell me about what's you and Bobby. What's your story? And then they feel heard. They feel seen. And then there's connection. And that's what the book's about.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Andrew McCarthy's book, Who Needs Friends, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviaterolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.